Welcome to the Non-Breaking Space Show from Austin, Texas. I'm Christopher Schmidt, and on today's show, we talk with Dr. Susan Weinscheck, a behavior psychologist that works in the field of design and user experience. She's the author of How to Get People to Do Stuff, Neuro Web Design, What Makes Them Click, and 100 Things Every Designer Needs to Know About People. Before we get started, some things I'd like you to know. Make plans for CSS DevConf 2017. Join Chris Coyer, Wes Boss, Mina Markham, Harry Roberts, Sarah Drasner, Estelle Weil, and many more in New Orleans this October. Early bird tickets are on sale right now at cssdevconf.com. The UX Design Newsletter is a weekly list of articles, tutorials, and inspiration handpicked by yours truly. So sign up at uxdesignnewsletter.com and have the best links of the week sent to your email. Speaking of email, set it and forget it with the Non-Breaking Space Show newsletter. Whenever a new show is ready, be notified in your inbox by signing up at newsletter.nonbreakingspace.tv. Of course, you can always find show notes and links discussed to today's episode at nonbreakingspace.tv. And be sure to follow me on Twitter at Telject, T-E-L-E-J-E-C-T. And if you like today's show, please let others know and tell them to look on iTunes for the Non-Breaking Space Show. Now, on with the show. But yeah, but thank you so much for taking time out.
Yeah, no problem.
To do this. I literally have no idea where to start. I've been actually trying to figure out where to start asking the first question. But I guess the first question I would ask is like, what is your, you have a PhD and you write books about how people, you know, what makes people click online and you consult with companies. I just want to know what your normal typical day is, in terms of, or what's your normal concern, project with the company in terms of performance?
It varies a lot. Yeah. It really does. I mean, it's funny. Sometimes people ask me to, kind of coach and mentor them in either starting or growing their, business if they have a small business. And I like doing that. It's a lot of fun. And then I realize I give them really good advice, and then I don't follow that advice in my business. So, for instance, you know, the advice is that if you pick a small niche, right, and be the, you know, especially if you're a small business, and just be, you know, the best you can be in that one area, you know, that's the better way to go, rather than do this and this and this. And that. Of course, I don't follow that. So that's why if you ask me, you know, what's a typical kind of project, it'd be like, whoa. So for instance, right now I'm on a project. I'm actually doing something I think is so much fun, and it's really different for me. I always wanted to be a science advisor on a TV show, because I have a PhD in psychology, and I don't know. I always thought that would be fun. So that right now I'm doing that. And that's just like, it's so crazy. It's very intense. That means I'm spend a lot of time actually reading research papers and summarizing them and thinking about what you could do with that that would be visual, because it's TV, and meetings with the team. A lot of time, you know, I do a little bit of consulting, but I spend a lot of my time doing online video training and keynote speaking. And so a lot of my time is spent planning curriculum and thinking about how I want to explain a topic and, working on new presentations and new courses. So that means I'm, you know, in my office and me and the computer, you know, and me and the computer and the thoughts in my head. And I spend a fair amount. I'm not working on a book at the moment, but, you know, I still do blog posts and stuff. So I spend a fair amount of time writing. And then I have a podcast that I do. So I spend time talking into my trusty microphone, right? Okay. Just like you.
Yes, that's awesome. Can you tell me which TV show it is? Because I didn't.
It's actually a YouTube Red original series. Do you know what YouTube is doing?
Yeah, YouTube. I know what YouTube Red is. YouTube Red is their subscription service.
Yes, and they have original programming that they're putting out. And so this is season two of Mindfield. Season one was not. I wasn't involved in season one, but now I've joined the team for season two. So
okay.
It's all about psychology.
So yeah, Mindfield, I guess it's M-I-N-D, I guess it's
M-I-N-D and then F-I-E-L-D. Yeah.
Okay.
It's with Michael Stevens, who does Vsauce. I don't know if you know him at all, but he's great.
Cool. Yeah, I love and weirded out by YouTube in general, just because of its reach and popularity.
Yeah.
Just because people who've listened to this podcast have heard me talk about it before, but I'll be very quick about it. So let's just skip it. But yeah, I went to a YouTube conference, VidCon in LA.
Oh, okay.
Just because I had no idea.
That must have been interesting.
Yeah, because it's a bunch of tweens. Because it's part like a social, event. And then they're trying to add this at the time, kind of like this creator track as well, and it was kind of it needs some work, and they probably fixed a lot of holes in it by the time I mean it's like the first time they're doing it, so whatever.
Yeah,
but yeah, I was just totally floored with how crazy popular things are, like with the tweens, with YouTube, right? And so it's like, and one of the things I say, like you know, there's TV stars that would not kill but would love to have the popularity of YouTube stars.
Really?
Yeah.
I know. Yeah. I was just thinking the other day about, like, wow, the people who came up with YouTube, like, why couldn't I have come up with that idea? Yeah.
YouTube was like kind of a, when Google bought YouTube, it was almost like some people, and you wouldn't be laughed at for thinking this and that but then, but they're like, why did we buy this thing? You know, because you couldn't really, you know, digital cameras weren't, you know, you didn't have the iPhone yet. You know, you did, that was still like a year or two away, if I remember my dates right. You know, so you couldn't really readily upload video.
Wasn't easy.
Yeah, so you still had the point and click video cameras.
Yeah, I know, but I wish I had thought it up.
Yeah.
All kinds of things I recognize as being good ideas when they're out there, but then I just go, how come I can't be the one that thinks this up and does it, and you know, makes millions of dollars? But somehow, that hasn't happened yet. I still got time.
There we go. Cool. Well, let's think about so one of the things I read about you talk about habits, and it's March, so it's not. But you wrote an article about New Year's habits.
Yeah, New Year's resolutions. Yeah.
I felt like the cool part of that was self stories.
Yeah.
In terms of forming habits, could you explain like how a self story can help people make habits? Because like I've given up on making New Year's resolutions because I feel like they're just a waste of time. Like just like I will break it, and then it's a race for me to break it. You know, it's not the fact that I will break it is the issue, because it will happen. It's like, can I get past 31 days? Because then I feel like, oh, okay, at least I stretch it out that far. But what are self studies and how can they be?
Yeah, well, I just love the work of Timothy Wilson. He's actually responsible for getting me into the whole field of unconscious mental processings, which I got into maybe about 10 or 15 years ago or so. And he wrote this book called Redirect. It's actually not his first book. And we had him on our podcast. I was so thrilled. This was like, you know, I get to have Timothy Wilson on my podcast. Yeah. So I was a little bit of like a, you know, what's a, there's a term for when you're like a fan and you're just like overwhelmed, you know?
Fangirl, fanboy.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, he's a university professor. He's a very, you know, down to earth kind of person. Not, yeah, he's not, you wouldn't normally think of him as a celebrity, but I do. But he wrote this book called Redirect, which is just a great book about his research and other people's research on self stories. And so the idea is that we all have stories about, you know, who we are and what's important to us and why we do what we do. And some of these stories we're consciously aware of, and some of them, a lot of them, are unconscious. And, you know, these are the stories we tell to others or we tell to ourselves. And his research shows really clearly, it's very powerful, that if, in fact, I've come to believe it is the only way you really get long-term large behavior change. So there's a whole science about habits that I talked about in that article as well, which I think works really well, especially if you're just talking about something little, you know, like I always give the example of, you know, I should be drinking more water, or, you know, I should eat more vegetables, or I should get more exercise, which I consider little things. But if you're talking about making a change in your life that's like really big, habit will only get you like, you know, this far. You could, of course, probably chain like 100 habits together, and then you maybe you'd get that far. But for really big change, the best thing to do is to change your self story. And because that is, that so drives your behavior, when you change some of these deep self stories, it automatically, without you even realizing it, changes your behavior. And then the other thing I think that was surprising from his work is that it's actually really easy to change your self story, because you'd think, well, that must be hard to do, but you can do it. I mean, he did it in 20 to 30 minutes. He had people change their self story in a way that then stuck and affected them for the rest of their lives. Wow. So I don't know if you want any more details about it, but I was so impressed when I read his book. It was like, yeah, this is great, great stuff.
So what is a self story? Like, if someone's listening right now, like, what would they?
Yeah, well, I'll give you, I can give you an example he uses in his research. So he was working with college kids who, you know, people who had started college and, you know, in their like first or second semester, somewhere in their first year, they weren't doing well, right? They were maybe on the verge of dropping out. So students who were kind of at risk. And he brought them in and, you know, it was a scientific experiment. So some of them watched a video, a 20-minute video, and some of them did, you know, another task for 20 minutes. He had different conditions. But one of the things he did was one group would watch a 20-minute video, and in the video would be other students, and these were real students, who had been in a similar situation when they were freshmen, and who talked about, you know, and they all, and so it was like a 20-minute video vignette of a couple of different students. And one student would say like, well, yeah, when I first came to college, I wasn't doing well. And, you know, I was partying too much. Or another student would say, when I first came to college, I didn't have confidence that I was going to be able to do it. And so then I just, you know, the first time I didn't get a good grade on an exam, I just kind of gave up, you know. And then another student would say, well, you know, I was capable of doing the work, but my study skills were really not up to par. And, but then I got help at the, you know, center at the tutor place where they have tutors and they help you with study skills. And so they just kind of told their story about how they were not doing well and then what intervention they did. And then they would say at the end, so then I realized it wasn't that I'm, you know, not capable, or it wasn't that I had to just accept I had poor study skills. I mean, they had changed their self story, and they explained that in the video. So when he showed this video with these couple of people telling their self story initially, and then how they changed it and how they were now, because these people in the video were all graduating from college and they had been successful, that caused the people watching to change their self stories. And that group that watched the video and then were asked to talk a little bit at the end of the video about which of these, right, do you think describes you? And so therefore we're doing what he would call story editing. So they were editing their self stories based on what they had seen other people do. And he tracked them, and a really large percentage of them changed and became successful. And, you know, when he interviewed them before they graduated, you know, they said, well, you know, I changed my study skills and so on. And the other groups, though, that went through a 20-minute intervention in some other way but didn't watch those videos, they had much lower success rates. They had not changed. And that was just one example in his book. He has many examples. So just by doing that editing, just by saying to yourself, okay, maybe I'm not, maybe it's not true that I'm a lazy person, or maybe it's not true, you know, that I have to accept that I'm not as smart as the other people here. You know, maybe that's not true, right? And maybe I am a smart person, right? Saying that and really believing it, changing that story internally, it just changed, you know, like probably 50 different behavior patterns that then led to them being successful. So I'm just a big fan of, and in fact, I will actually periodically in my life, I sit down with pen and I do it with pen and paper because sometimes I type it because I hate handwriting. But there's actually research to show that when you write something by hand, it activates different parts of your brain than if you type. So I try to do it by hand. But I'll sit down and I'll just write out, here's what I think my story is right now. And then I'll think about the things that, as I've written it, are things I really like about my life and don't want to change. But then I'll look at the story and I'll realize, you know, I've got a little thing in here. There's a little pattern in here, a little story going on that I don't like, right? And it's not serving me and it's making me, you know, not have as much fun or not be as positive as or whatever it is. And then I rewrite the story. Because when you think about it, you know, there's always more than one way to look at any given situation, right? I mean, I'm sitting here in my home studio and I could either say, well, you know, it's a gray day. I'm looking out the window. It's really gray. I'm in this little town in Wisconsin and, you know, this is how I communicate with people. You know, I'm in my house alone all day. And if I'm going to talk to anybody, it's on a TV screen. You know, what kind of life is this, right? I mean, I could tell the story that way, or I could say, well, you know, it's a gray day because it's been raining because it's spring. We made it through winter in Wisconsin and I'm so excited about spring. And how lucky am I to be able to live in this little town in Wisconsin where it's nice and quiet and inexpensive and yet be able to talk to people all around the world, you know, is not like a great thing. So I'm describing the same thing, but there's two really different stories to it. Right. And, you know, the way you describe your life and who you are and how you're interacting with other people just has a huge effect on everything, your mood, but also the way you interact with people, right?
Right. Yeah, I've also heard it described as like a filter, like a lens in which you see the world is like, you can have a, like a, not a rose colored glasses, but like a more positive view of a situation, or you can have a negative view of a situation.
Yeah, you know, it's, right. Because stuff happens all the time, right? I mean, you can't control everything that might happen in your life, but you can look, like as you said, you can look at it through this filter or that filter. You know, this can be an opportunity or this can be a defeat.
Right.
I can have some control over my life, or I can be a victim. You know, I mean, so anyway, that's why the self stories are so powerful. So if you change, in terms of New Year's resolutions, right, or wanting to make changes in your life, In fact, I believe, you know, unless you change your self story, you won't be able to make changes because, you know, you, if you still have the same story operating, let's say you have a story which is, you know, I'm past the peak of my career. You know, they say that if, once you're past 35, you know, your brain is right. I mean, if you've got that story operating, then how are you ever going to write a book if you're over 35, right? Because you'll be constantly, well, I might as well not, you know, and a lot of this unconscious, right? I might as well not even try because I don't have the brain power. I should have written it 10 years ago because now I'm too old to write it, right? Yeah. So are you really going to write the book and finish it? Maybe not. Yeah.
Right? But for self stories, it sounds like the best way, like, to do it is to actually write it down, like write down like what you think is your current point of view. And I just want to rehash this. So you write down like what's how you see the world. And then you also, it's like write it and make sure the act of writing, I think you thought you mentioned it, like it triggers something else in the brain rather than a keyboard. And is that just, you know, cause I remember like Moleskine notebooks, they're actually phrases. I write it down so I remember it later. And that is so me because I can type something, a to-do list, but I will totally forget it because I just typed it on my keyboard. And whereas if I write it down in a notebook, Moleskine notebook, whatever, I'll actually remember it and I'll actually just feel notes, not Moleskine, but
yeah, it is different. And I don't know about whether anyone's done research about, you know, is that because when we were young, we wrote things by hand? So generations now that are growing up doing very little handwriting and mainly writing on a keyboard, will this be true for them? I don't know. So I don't know if it has to do with just, how your brain got wired when you were young and the effect of writing by hand, or if it really is just anybody writing by hand. It might be the latter because your hand moving through space does change the wiring. For instance, people who learn a language that like English, which is not very pictorial. I mean, it is somewhat, right? You're drawing symbols. Mm-hmm. But if you're learning a language like Chinese or Japanese, where it is a much more pictorial language, their brain looks different when they learn to write that than someone who writes A, B, C, D. So we know that the movement of the hand changes the wiring of the brain. So I suspect it really does have to do with writing by hand. Having said that, if you hate writing by hand, I'd rather you do some story editing on the keyboard than not do it at all, right?
So I find it like totally amazing just to by writing a story of how you see things and then changing things and then writing the story you want to be liberating. Like, yeah. And if I did, like, it would give you like bigger steps than trying to change your habit, like, which is like what you mentioned earlier, is like small steps. I felt like that was.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what I think is so exciting about the story editing is, well, first of all, I want to make a distinction because the process I described to you is actually story writing.
Okay. Sorry.
One thing I want to say is you had mentioned, well, you write the story of how you want to be. That's not exactly it because it's really important that you write what is currently true.
Oh, okay.
But through that different filter. So you don't write, like I wouldn't write, you know, I'm a 25-year-old, woman who's 5'7" and, or 5'9" and is a great athlete, you know, because I'm 5 feet tall and, you know, I'm not 25 or 27. So you want to be, it has to be grounded in reality. Otherwise what's going to happen is your unconscious brain is going to say, it's not me. it's too far. But the other thing I want to say is that story writing, And you don't even have to do that. I mean, in the example I gave you of Wilson's research, that he called that story editing, which is even easier because they didn't even have to do anything. They just watched the darn video, you know?
Yeah, well, in your book, I think it's the How Many People Do Stuff. You ask people, you point out that to convince people to do something, one is to look great, be attractive, and then two is to actually I forgot what number two was. I got hung up on attractiveness, another point you made was be attractive, but also if people could relate to you in terms of being on the same wavelength. I say the same wavelength, but they felt like you were in their tribe, if you will, if I can use that word.
Yeah.
That way they would say like, hey, they would be able to take you in and accept what you're saying and then probably go and do what you ask. And yeah. So I feel like in your example that you gave, it would it be the fact that the people who in that study, which is someone else's study, but I felt like maybe they're watching a video of someone who is also in their same predicament.
Yes, same predicament, and is kind of like them, right? Right. They're college students at the same college,
right,
as they are, and had the same kind of problem that right. they had. So you then identify, right, and say, yeah, that's what's going on with me, right? Right. And I think that, I think we've all had the experience, maybe we haven't, but, watching a movie or watching someone sing a song they wrote or, and just really identifying with it and having it affect you very deeply and these moments where, okay, that changed my life, right? I went to that performance or I saw that movie and I realized that, and again, a lot of times it's not conscious. Like they're not really aware that they've had that. They may be aware that something's different, right? That event or that piece of art work that they saw or that performance changed them in some way. They may not be able to articulate it clearly.
And one of your books also, you mentioned, it was like just a short thing, but I felt like it was very powerful in terms of software development in terms of instructions. Cause everyone, when the iPhone came out, you could not, shake a stick without seeing someone, a project manager say like, we got to get our instructions down to a size of a card that came with the iPhone. Right. Cause this is all they need to know to learn how to use an iPhone or an iPad or whatever. So one of the things that you mentioned was said like, hey, when you have a new product, you consult with companies, don't just list all this software package can, in your example, so it was like an upload is a photo uploader or something you can edit photos, you can do X, Y, Z, like this application has these features or say you can upload photos right now or something like that. And which one of these two do people want react better to? And that was the one where it's you and your, the possessions where you,
yeah.
And so and so people can relate to that because I can actually do something with the software.
Right. Right. And I mean, the whole idea of stories then also feeds into, products, right. And product design and product marketing. So, am I the kind of person that uses or buys this product? Like, is that me? Is that my tribe? Right? Right. And that has to do with self-stories. So I think it's extremely important to try and get an understanding of what are the operating self-stories of the people that you're either writing instructions for or designing for or trying to sell to. Yeah.
Right. Is that so trying to find the personas or trying to find, understand your customer base? And
It is. But so I think, sometimes people think personas is, so when I'm working on it, I was telling you about I'm doing the science advising on this TV show, and that's the first time I've ever done a project like that. So most of my projects are, evaluating a product and telling them what they should do differently to make it more engaging or more usable, or, you know, kind of more of the behavioral science behind design, or more of the more traditional, you know, user experience design. But I'll always ask, you know, when I'm working on a project like that, you know, do you have personas? That's one of my early questions. You know, do you have personas you're using on this project? It's always a problem when I'm in a room and I ask that question and they kind of look at each other and say, do we have personas? And then it's like, hey, we don't have operating personas. Yeah. And then I always ask to look at them if they have them. And, you know, it's so interesting because sometimes they are, you know, okay. It's more a description of the marketing demographic. You know, we sell to people who, you know, have this income and live here and, you know, use these products. And it's like, okay, but I need to try and get an understanding of the operating self stories that are underneath here. And obviously, you know, people are individual and I'm not going to be able, you know, you sell a product. We're not going to be able to take the millions of people who use it and all give them one self story, but we can certainly parse out, you know, what are the five likeliest self stories that are going to be operating and that would motivate someone to be interested in this product. And if you don't know that, which sometimes you don't, you know, then you got to, I mean, that's, I love doing like, I call it exploratory target audience research, which is, you know, doing kind of deep interviews with current or potential clients and to find out, you know, what are the self stories that are really common to the people who'd be interested in this product.
So what's a deep interview?
You know, a deep interview is it's hard to describe. It's using what I call a structured interview protocol. So you have a series of questions that you may ask and you may not ask. So you start with, I did one of these not too long ago for, I won't say who it is, confidentiality stuff, but it's for a large, fairly well-known online retailer of clothing and apparel, and who it is a very, very successful company. But they weren't sure that they really did know some of these self stories, and especially for potential new customers, because, you know, they had a really strong customer base, but that customer base was getting older. And it's like, okay, we got to make sure we stay relevant with younger people who aren't used to shopping with us. And so they had, you know, we identified who those people were and where we would find them. We recruited them. And then I actually got it. This was done actually with, you know, with a tool. I didn't see them because that's often hard for people. They don't have the cameras hooked up. They don't have a camera, but I could hear them. And then we went to this company's website. But first I just asked them, you know, when was the last time you bought clothing or apparel, you know, online? And interestingly, we kind of already knew that answer to that, because that's all asked when you recruit them, you know, so the recruiting company had that, but it's a way to start the conversation. So then you just start talking and they're like, oh, well, I bought a shirt for my husband, you know, about 2 weeks ago. And that's like, oh, okay. So when you're going to buy something online for yourself or someone else, you know, where do you usually go? Oh, I usually go here or there. And then we just start talking about, you know, well, what's important to you when you're buying stuff online? If you just start talking and then you go, then we would go to the website and, you know, well, let's say you were going to buy a shirt here, you know, like what would you do? But so we're not testing the website though. We're really just using it as a vehicle to have a conversation, and you find out the most amazing things. Like, the reason the company wanted to do this was they had a whole brand identity, you know, and they had these ideas about what was really important about the process and about the website. And they wanted to know whether that was true. Wow. And was that still true? And was it, so the things that they thought were really important, is that what their audience thought? And it did what some of them, some of the, you know, I call them the sacred cows, you know, did not match. Were not important. And that was hard for them to hear, right? Because it's like, well, we built our entire company around this idea and nobody cares. But, you know, people would talk about, you know, how really get real emotional. It's amazing to me how emotional people can get about shopping, you know, but really emotional about wanting to share that shopping was a way to have meaningful time with her daughter, this one woman said, you know. It was like her daughter was a teenager and they weren't getting along. And, you know, this was the one thing they could do together without fighting, you know. And in another deep interview I did for a different client, I had a 45-year-old guy was in the room. This was in person. And he was crying. Because, and this was an interview about hooking up televisions, buying a TV and bringing it home and hooking it up. Yeah. But yeah, and a lot of the people in that we interviewed got very emotional because what, you know, he said, I'm supposed to be like, this is my role in a family, you know, he's. Tears. I got to be the one who knows how to hook. You know, if I get the TV and I can't hook it up, you know, and my family's sitting there waiting for it to be hooked, and I didn't get the right cable. You know, I mean, it was like this big, and big emotional experience. And he was not the only one that reacted that way. And I was like, wow. So this story, right? Mm-hmm. He had a story, and apparently this is a common story for the people that shopped at that store and bought that kind of product. His story was, you know, I'm the tech guy who's knowledgeable. You know, I have to really have this together. And so that translated into the fact that when they sell things like, you know, really large screen TVs, you know, they need to sell the whole package and all the cables and, you know, you have to be sure you know exactly what you're doing without admitting that you don't know what you're doing to the salesperson, right? Because your story is that you know what you're doing and yet the salesperson has to explain it to you because you don't really know what you're doing, you know? But understanding that dynamic is going on, you know, means that people are going to want to buy their large tech stuff from you because they know when they go home, they know what they're doing, you know, not just their story. So I just think those are great examples of, you know, I think we forget that people make purchases as part of, you know, who they are and the story that they feel about themselves.
Right. Yeah. It's just like, the purchases are an extension of themselves and what they, and it's important when they bring home is important to them too. So it's an extension of what they decide to bring home. Yeah. Cause like I've been to companies where personas are marketing speak, you know, marketing departments or someone else's best guesses as to, of who their audience is and they don't actually go out and ask people, you know, their customers are what they're doing. So yeah. So yeah, that's why I kind of like, you know, personas. I have a, like, that's one reason why I ask you, like, well, how do you get personas? Cause I just feel like I'm doing it wrong.
And, you know, I think this back to stories. I mean, to make sure that when you're doing those interviews, you have people tell you stories, you know, tell me about the last time you bought a TV, mm-hmm. you know, that's the stuff that comes out as they tell the story rather than, you know, where did you buy your last TV and what kind of TV did you buy? You know, what you need is the story of how they made the decision and how it went, You know, it was unbelievable to me how many, you know, bad stories you get. I mean, just, and how upset people were when, you know, the wrong shirt arrived. I mean, that was, they would talk for like a half an hour.
Yeah.
About their frustration about the wrong shirt arriving.
Like they were personally wronged, is that type of thing? Or is it more just like just upset type of thing? Or was it like, was
that personal? It depended on the person and what their story was. Yeah. But yeah. You know, for some people it was, you obviously don't care about me.
Yeah.
You know, you don't take, you'll take my money, but you won't send me the right shirt, you know. And for other people, it was just about how, you know, it was so disappointing and, you know, it was supposed to be a present and now the present, you know, they weren't going to be able to give the present on time. And so right. The story varied, but it was like, and they had lots of these stories. People really remember when stuff goes wrong, especially with an online purchase. They seem to really remember that.
Well, and that also goes to trust, which you also talk in your book about like, and trust is really tough because, like, you know, in the, you know, dinosaur days of the internet, you know, when Amazon was selling books and just books, you know, people would say like, I can't believe we're buying online, right? You know, just like, wow. And now people, you know, buy computer devices that like listen to what you say from Amazon, and
yeah,
they're always on listening to you. It's like oh, I guess that's okay. And so, but yeah, so that's trust, and like in terms of convincing people that you're doing okay, and you know, having run a small business is just like, and customer support is a big issue. I think Amazon kind of unlocked that a little bit with doing like, you know, I'm going to respond to your email or customer support issue within 24 hours. It set this bar that, you know, that you need to turn around in order to get trust. And so if someone does complain about their shirt or whatnot, it's, you know, and if there is an issue, problem, or whatever, like to resolve it as soon as possible in a way that makes them happy. Just so that, when they think about your brand again, it's not seeing a negative light, but also like, I feel like if you're buying a TV, that's like once in a blue moon, you know, or longer
right.
purchase. It's not something that happens every day or every right. year. So, you know, I was just, you know, I think the last TV I bought was like, you know, like 8 years ago or something like that.
Yeah, the one I bought was a long time ago.
Right. And it's, you know, and then I feel upset because every time I see my TV, it's like, man, that thing is so thick. All the new TVs are like wafer thin. Like, I don't know. How do I survive with this, you know, so with this HD capable, I can't breathe. but yeah, so it's so I don't know if your stores is just, I feel like also like same with buying a car, it's like you don't buy a car every day. And so there's, I think personally for me is kind of realization of when buying a car or buying a big product TV, just like do as much research as you can, but realize like you are just, you know, you're not an expert because you don't do this every day. And so you're actually beholden to the company that's buying it to you to treat you fair and right. So and when you make that purchase, and so I can see like there's definitely a lot of room for trust to be from the company to actually showcase, you know.
For yeah, you know, it's interesting with Amazon. You know, Amazon is, they spend a lot of their time and energy and money on the back end, right? I mean, they're like masters of algorithms. And I'm not saying they don't spend time on their interface design, but I mean, my guess is, and I'm totally guessing, if you looked either at how much time and money they spend, or if you went to the top level people and asked them what's more important, this or that, you know, probably that back end stuff is, I mean, I know that's important to them. But interestingly, that does end up having a huge effect. I mean, I remember just a week ago, we have an electric tea kettle, you know, and it started acting strangely. And I thought, well, gee, you know, I'm like any company's nightmare of a consumer. I will not let go, you know?
Oh yeah.
I have a very funny story about North Face and a tent. But anyway, that's okay. I won't tell you that one right now. But I was like, okay, so it's a tea kettle. I don't want to spend money on a tea kettle. Is there a warranty on this? And I was like, I don't know. You know, where and when did I buy it? And I thought, well, chances are pretty good. I bought it on Amazon because we buy everything on Amazon. And, you know, in like 2 seconds, right, I can go online and Amazon has my orders for years. Right. So I just searched on, you know, tea kettle under my orders and there it was. And I bought it almost 3 years ago. And, you know, here's the order, right? Here's the date. Here's the price. Here's the model number, right? So then I could call up the company that made it and found out I was 1 month from warranty going out. Yeah. It was a 3-year warranty and I was 1 month away. But, you know, it's like, so I really appreciated, right, that. Yeah. Amazon had that history and that I could find it that fast. And it's worth it to me, you know, to shop at Amazon just because I know that 3 years from now,
yeah,
I can, you know, I can instantly have that. I use, I mean, people laugh at me. I use Amazon as my address book.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I want to send out a birthday card, I go to Amazon. Chances are I've sent that person a gift at some point.
Oh man.
And I could find their address on there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I totally. Yeah. With the customer support being like, what is like, I really want to hear your tent story, but so I'll swap you my story, which is still ongoing, but, yeah. But to talk about like bad customer support, which is, you know, I don't fully put the blame on the company, but it's their fault. But, it's, have you heard of Instant Pot? At all, the it is part crock pot and part 6 other cooking devices.
Really?
It's they've been written up in terms of like it's kind of a viral thing about how popular they become without really advertising that much. And so, it basically is like a pressure cooker, crock pot, boiler type thing, and in one device. And so it's pretty cool. Just to things that would take hours can like a half hour or whatever. So anyway.
Yeah.
So I bought one as a gift for someone, and then we bought one for ourselves. And so, and I decided, like, you know, to learn how to cook this thing one day when everyone else is gone for the weekend. I was like, I'm going to learn how to cook for this thing because I'm not a big fan of cooking. I'm going to learn how to, like, I'll become a ninja with this thing. The first meal, I nuke this thing, I fry it. And it's just like, it's supposed to do 7 things, which I told you about. I went from one stage to the second stage. And by going to the second stage, it somehow blew the fuse, which I think is, I'm not even sure that's what happened because I'm still talking to customer support. And so they have a phone number and they have their line, their email thing. So I left them a voicemail. They did get back to me like Monday, you know, but you know, I'm busy working. So I'm like, I don't have time to deal with this. And so, but basically when I get back to them in time, it's like, you will have to do a customer support ticket online. It's like, well, I kind of defeats the purpose of me talking to you on the phone, but whatever. So I go through the support ticket. It's like, send us your photos of you buying the thing, like your invoice. Show us a photo of your the serial number. Show us just show us everything. Make sure like you literally have this thing. Yeah. And I was like, oh my God, like seriously, like, okay. Right. And then, so I set the ticket in and I was like, oh, I'm done with this ticket. And,
yeah.
Cause I've given all the information.
Yeah.
And I referenced it in the voicemail and it says like, thank you for submitting it. It's going to take longer than a day to 2 days to get back to you because we're just so
swamped
insanely popular. And I was just like, I was so upset with that because like, as you know, that's not true. Because if you actually spent the time on the quality of the product, you would have less customer support issues.
Right. You have 50,000 of these being returned. Okay.
Yeah. So like,
you're so popular.
Right. So I was just like, So I was like, oh, I'm so upset with that because you know, it's the book is Quality is Free. Basically, it talks about this whole concept of like you actually pay money up front.
Yeah.
Your customer support costs go way down. And I can totally understand it's like version one of the product or two, but it's been a while. And so, and I know Jack about the Instant Pot business, whatever, but I'm just like, seriously. So the week goes by, I haven't heard from them. So I sent out like, hey guys,
what's up? What's going on? Yeah.
My family is not unhappy with me because I nuked their cooking utensil. and they wrote back, it's like, oh yeah, sorry about that. Blah, blah, blah. It's been, we think you're right that the fuse was blown. Can you please send us more photos of XYZ? Yeah. Of like, and half the stuff they wanted was the stuff I've already sent them. And I was just like, I just threw my hands up the air.
Did you feel like maybe you should send them like photos of unhappy faces from your family? You
know? Oh, I'm going to do that now. That's a great idea. I'm going to do that. Unhappy.
Yeah, photos. You got. So I can tell you what to do here.
Okay. Tell me.
Because this isn't resolved, right?
No, this is still ongoing. I have like not.
Yeah, I mean, basically, I get into this, you know, it's the principle of the thing. And so I had, this is my tent story. I'll try and make it short. But my family, we used to go camping every year. We don't anymore. But when I had kids and they were young and every year we'd go camping and we would go like for 2 weeks, you know, out in the wilderness. And so having a good tent was really important. And we spent, so at one point we spent a lot of money. We got like North Face's fanciest, most expensive tent, you know, just an ungodly amount of money. And we took the tent out and used it for the first time and it rained and the water just poured in the tent. It's like we've been tenting for like, you know, years and years and years with other tents. We've never, you know, the rain is not supposed to come in the tent. And it wasn't like a deluge. It was just like regular rain. So obviously there's something wrong with the tent, right? So we get back from the camping trip and I contact them and say, you know, there's a problem with the tent. And they say, okay, you know, send in the tent. So I send in the tent to them and then I don't hear anything. Right. So then I start calling and then I went through, it was this really interesting thing. The whole thing took like, I think 3 months. And it started with, you know, I would call them and they would say, oh, well, it's very busy and we have a lot of tents here and our customer service department. First, it was like the customer service department just moved. Mm-hmm. And so we moved everything everyone had sent in with us. And then like I would call in again and it was like, oh, well, Shelly is on maternity leave, you know, so I'm not talking to Shelly. Then I would call in again and I was finding out how Shelly's baby was. I mean, it was like I had a friendship now going with them. But then finally, as time went on and nothing happened with the tent. And then I got a letter. This was great. And I didn't save the letter I don't think I saved it. I actually got accused of tent abuse. There was a phrase in there that said, we believe you have committed tent abuse.
Committed tent abuse.
Yes.
That was a phrase
I didn't. That was the phrase they use. And I was like, like I had done something to the tent, which I didn't, which meant that it would rain in. Plus, by the way, they wanted me to know that the tent was not meant to be used in all conditions. like it's not like it's never going to rain. You know. So then what I started doing was, this was the final campaign.
Okay.
I called. I found out who the woman was in charge of customer service. And I called her every day and called her. Now she was in California and I'm in Wisconsin. So I purposely called when I knew she wouldn't be there.
Okay.
Like early in the morning her, you know, and I would very nicely, I would just start talking and I'd say, hi, Tara, this is Susan in Wisconsin. We've talked before and I would tell her the whole story and I would fill up her voicemail every day. There would be no room for anyone else's voicemails.
Tell her every salacious detail of your tent abuse.
Oh yeah. 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 We'd say, I'd tell the story all over but I was always very nice, you know, hi Tara. Yeah. It's Susan. So, you know, I'm thinking about the tent. I mean, you know, I would just like go on and fill up her voicemail. And then finally, one day my phone rings and really the voice says, just give me the address to send the check to. And I said, pardon me? And she said, this is Tara. Just give me the address. She was so fed up. And a check arrived in the mail for the full amount, and we were done. Nice. So you have to be, here's what you have to do. You have to be nice.
Yes.
You have to be very specific about what you want.
Right.
And then you have to make it so not dealing with you is worse than dealing with you. You know, like they just want you to go away.
Away, yeah.
And what can they do? And you've told them exactly what they need to do to make you go away. You got to be really specific. Because I had said to her, I just want a check for the total amount of the tent.
Yeah.
I don't want a new tent. I don't want you to repair the tent. I just want a check for the tent. Yeah, there you go. That's my secret to customer service.
Right. Because you're right. Because the minute you're not nice, isn't it? They have an excuse to hang up on you and not talk to you.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to be nice, but you can't, you just got to be really persistent. So you're going to have to call these people.
Oh, man. I love that. Yeah. Because I haven't told anyone this, like, other than people I work with, because I don't want it to be flung on me at all. But this is actually for my dad, but this is the patented. I actually patented. He told me the idea. I patented. Is the how to be the Christopher annoying technique to get what you want. And you have to, so you ask for something and someone hasn't given it to you yet, right? It could be like a file or some sort of thing or whatever. And so, so basically you say, like, you know, it's agreed that they were supposed to get something, you didn't get it, whatever. My editor should not be listening to this right now. So, but is that first you do the email.
Yeah.
Day one. Day two, voicemail.
Yeah.
And then repeat. And then you're like, sounds like, but your idea of just filling out the voicemail sounds awesome. But but I have never had the patented annoying Chris Schmidt technique go past 4 days without getting a solution. Yeah.
That's good.
It hasn't. But I have not graduated to the tent level scale, though, in terms of like issue.
I had a funny thing happen where I was had a problem with a service, not a product. And I was so frustrated. I wrote about it on my personal Facebook page.
Yeah.
And just because, you know, it's like, can you believe this? And it just so happened, I did not know this, that one of my personal Facebook friends worked for a marketing company. And that company that I was talking about and that page at the website where and the whole process with that product, with that service, was one of her clients.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't know this, but she at first I didn't know it. She told me later. She called her client who then was like the director of marketing. And said, are you kidding me? You know, like, I designed this wonderful page. People fill out the page and they go into the dark abyss of this. Look what happened. And then she said, and did you have to piss off Susan Wineshank, like a well-known speaker on user experience? Like, that was who you and I didn't know she had done this until later, but all of a sudden, like, you know, so I'm in this like dispute with the company and trying to work things out. And I get a call from like, the director of marketing of a large insurance company. And then I found out that's why I had gotten that call. I was like, why am I getting a call from the director of marketing? Yeah, I haven't escalated it that far yet.
I'm not that good, but I'm good, but I'm not that good yet.
Yeah, customer service is just such an interesting thing. It's so important. And people just, you know, they just don't realize it. You know, this one customer service person was emailing me and telling me, you know, that my emails to her were rude. And I think I had put one word in all caps. It was like, it was like, you know, your or my, or it was something like that. And that she started lecturing me on how all capital letters was shouting and I was being very rude. And it's like, well, you know, I'm about to spend like $18,000 with you. All I want, I just wanted like a full list of the what would be covered. It was insurance. We can't send that out, she said. I'm like, you think I'm going to spend $18,000 and not know what the coverage is? Like, would you spend $18,000? The coverage is? And she's like, you're being rude, and we're not going to have, if you're going to be rude, we're not going to have any more interactions. It was like, so you don't want my $18,000? I was just like so confused, you know? I don't know what's people don't get it. I guess maybe they're really stressed. I don't know.
Well, I feel I hope no one tells her about the internet. So that's my concern. It's like, oh, sorry if my uppercase letters of one word issue. I hope no one tells you about the internet that's out there. So.
Well, it was their form that was impossible to fill out. I don't know. People can be quite strange. I try to be nice, but I get probably not as nice as I should be. I'm sure I'm telling this story in a very biased way. Story is that I'm very nice with customer service people, but there are probably customer service people out here that are saying, that woman, she filled up my voicemail box.
That's awesome. I think we'll leave it on that one. That was awesome. Thank you so much. Susan, how can people find you on the internet and read more about your books?
Yeah. So our website is The Team W. That's T-H-E. And then the word team, TEAMW.com. My Twitter is @TheBrainLady. So one of those two ways are probably the best ways to find us.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the time that you took out to speak with us today.
I hope you get that cooking pot thing.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
I now feel more resolved to get it done. If not,
do it.
I will enjoy the journey. All right, cool.
Bye-bye.